Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. The vision of the end of civilization in Emily St. John Mandel's new novel would be chilling enough. A fast-moving plague from overseas wipes out nearly everyone it touches, even without the real-life Ebola outbreak still killing people in Africa. The novel, Station 11, jumps back and forth between the time leading up to the deadly flu outbreak and the time after, in which as much as 99% of the population is killed. It's from the remaining 1% that a traveling music and theater troupe emerges and journeys to the small outposts left in the Great Lakes region. Emily St. John Mandel is with us in the studio this morning to talk more about Station 11. Very nice to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you think we get as a society from thinking about the end of society as we know it?
I think we get a sense of what we have, these things that are so incredibly easy to take for granted. The way that, for example, somebody walked into this room this morning was probably you, flipped a switch and the room was flooded with electric light. Or you turn the faucet and water comes out of the tap. These are extraordinary things that I think we too easily take for granted and maybe don't even see anymore. And for me, setting a novel in a post-apocalyptic landscape was to write about those things by writing about their absence. So I saw the book as a kind of requiem, I suppose, or a sort of love letter to the modern world.
Have you had experiences in your life where the tenuousness of those kinds of things, the being able to throw a light switch or the ability to access any information you want at any time you want, has been evident that it might not always be there?
I have. I grew up on a very small island on the west coast of British Columbia. It's about the same size and shape as Manhattan with 1,000 people. And like many very rural places, the power lines were above ground. And so every time there was a winter storm, trees would fall on the lines, and we would be absolutely the last priority for the hydro company coming from Vancouver Island to make repairs. So it wasn't that unusual for power to be knocked out for 2 or 3 days at a time over the winter. And of course, in a place like that, there's no municipal water system. So in the summertime, our deep well would go dry. So we'd switch to a cistern, which pumped from a creek. And it just became incredibly convoluted, and you had to be careful how much water you used. So I think that upbringing might have given me some appreciation for how easily these things can go away.
Well, and maybe what it might look like if those things did go away.
That's true, although I'd never experienced it for more than a few days or a summer at a time. So when I was researching this book, I spent some time reading survivalist forums on the internet, which was exactly as unsettling as it sounds, but fascinating, you know, to find out the details of how people would and do live way off the grid.
There's a character in this book. Well, he starts life as – or he starts his adult life as a member of the paparazzi, but then
right.
As we meet him, he is – he's a paramedic.
Yes.
And – we later come to find, and we don't want to give much away in this book, but he survives for quite some time in a very enclosed place.
He was a character who I really liked, Jeevan. He starts off, as you said, as an entertainment guy, paparazzo, tries to become an entertainment journalist, fails, wants to do something that matters as he sees it. So starts to turn more toward medicine, and he's training to be an EMT as the book opens. And following the collapse, which in this book is a flu pandemic, he does find a way to pursue his interest in medicine and in helping people in a much greater way than he had before.
The end that has happened in this book happened very quickly, which seems like it's the key to the way things have fallen apart.
It is. The end in this book is a flu pandemic with a freakishly fast incubation period, which I would imagine some scientists would quibble with me about, but it's fiction. So.
Artistic license.
Exactly, yeah. So I had an extremely virulent strain in the book that kills a lot of people very quickly. You either die or you don't. And for the ones who don't, there are still quite a lot of resources around.
But they have to adjust to this life at the drop of a hat, essentially.
Exactly. This life after electricity, after everything we take for granted.
Well, so given these things that were percolating in your mind as you dreamed up this novel, where does the Traveling Symphony fit in?
The Traveling Symphony takes to the road, I suppose it's about 5 years after the collapse. And the book catches up with them around year 20. And my idea with this symphony was that presumably in the moments immediately following a societal collapse, it would all be blood and chaos and mayhem, which I didn't find that interesting to write about. That ground's been covered very thoroughly by novelists before me. What I did find interesting was to consider what the world might look like 15, 20 years out. Because mayhem is not a sustainable way of life for years and then decades. I think eventually we would be trying to figure out how to live peaceably with one another. And I had an idea that at that point, one of the burdens that survivors might carry would be memory. You know, of course, we think of remembering as being a good thing, and in most ways it is. But what a burden memory might be if you were having a hard time living in this new world. So I wanted to write about a group of people living together, and the symphony was a way of doing that. And I also thought that there might be a moment 15 or 20 years out when people might again be interested in things like music and theater and the things that make civilization civilization.
And there's also interesting parallel that goes on, because one of the things that the Traveling Symphony does, and it's not just a symphony, it puts on plays, is they put on Shakespeare. And Shakespeare, of course, has his own life marked by plague.
That's exactly it. Originally, in the early drafts, I had the symphony performing plays from a whole range of eras, from Shakespeare to David Mamet to modern teleplays, which might have been kind of funny, but there was something a little incongruous about performing episodes of Seinfeld in the post-apocalyptic landscape.
As delicious as that idea
exactly,
is.
Exactly, yeah. It started to seem somewhat insufficient. So I started narrowing it down to a repertoire that was before the age of electricity. And then as I read more about Shakespeare and his life, I begin to see some interesting parallels, as you alluded to. The most obvious being that in his time, theater would very often have been a matter of these small companies of traveling players moving from town to town. And also, as you mentioned, his life was so heavily marked by plague that it touched him personally. He lost several siblings. And it began to seem to me that the people in Shakespeare's era, which was Elizabethan England, dealing with these waves of bubonic plague sweeping again and again every few years over the landscape, that they would probably be people who are somewhat haunted by their memories of recent pandemics, which was an interesting parallel to the book I was writing.
And in the middle of all this is the character Arthur, who is one of a handful of characters and obviously the central character that doesn't make it into the post-flu era.
That's true. He dies in the first chapter, which is the night before the flu reaches Toronto, where he's performing King Lear.
But it strikes me that the kinds of stuff that the people who are living even 20 years after the flu hits are the kinds of things that he was already dealing with as he was about to meet his own demise.
That's interesting. Right. I mean, these are both before and after the flu, actors who are grappling with what it means to devote your life to acting, to devote your life to art, the joys and the costs of that. And I found it interesting to carry that thread through from a time that's more or less the present day to an unrecognizable world.
Well, I feel like we should hear a little of this.
Sure.
You have an excerpt that that you're going to read, and it actually probably doesn't need a lot of setup, but if you just want to read us into it a bit.
Sure, absolutely. So this is a section from after the collapse, when the Traveling Symphony has arrived in a somewhat unsettling little town that seems to have undergone a change in management since they were last there. I think all you need to know is that Kirsten and Saeed are actors with the symphony, and they're performing that evening. What was lost in the collapse? Almost everything. Almost everyone. But there is still such beauty. Twilight in the altered world, a performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream in a parking lot in the mysteriously named town of St. Deborah by the water, Lake Michigan shining a half mile away. Kirsten is Titania, a crown of flowers on her close-cropped hair, the jagged scar on her cheekbone half erased by candlelight. The audience is silent. Saeed, circling her in a tuxedo that Kirsten found in a dead man's closet near the town of East Jordan. Tarry, rash wanton, am I not thy lord? Then I must be thy lady. Lines of a play written in 1594, the year London's theaters reopened after two seasons of plague. Or written possibly a year later, in 1595, a year before the death of Shakespeare's only son. Some centuries later, on a distant continent, Kirsten moves across the stage in a cloud of painted fabric, half in rage, half in love. She wears a wedding dress that she scavenged from a house near New Potowski, the chiffon and silk streaked with shades of blue from a child's watercolor kit. But with thy brawls, she continues, thou hast disturbed our sport. She never feels more alive than at these moments. When on stage, she fears nothing. Therefore the winds, piping to us in vain, as in revenge, have sucked up from the sea contagious fogs. Pestilential, a note in the text explains, next to the word contagious, in Kirsten's favorite of the three versions of the text that the symphony carries. Shakespeare was the third born to his parents, but the first to survive infancy. Three of his siblings died young. His son, Hamnet, died at 11 and left behind a twin. Plague closed the theaters again and again, death flickering over the landscape. And now in a twilight once more lit by candles, the age of electricity having come and gone, Titania turns to face her fairy king. Therefore the moon, the governess of floods, pale in her anger, washes all the air, that rheumatic diseases do abound. Oberon watches her with his entourage of fairies. Titania speaks as if to herself now, Oberon forgotten. Her voice carries high and clear over the silent audience, over the string section waiting for their cue on stage left. And through this distemperature, we see the seasons alter. All three caravans of the Traveling Symphony are labeled as such, the Traveling Symphony, lettered in white on both sides. But the lead caravan carries an additional line of text, because survival is insufficient.
Emily St. John Mandel reading from Station 11. First of all, thank you.
Thank you.
And secondly, those of us who maybe did not necessarily see that particular episode come later to find out that that this line that it carries, the lead caravan carries with it, was taken from a Star Trek Voyager episode.
It was. It was an episode that aired, rather, in 1999 that had the line in it, survival is insufficient. And it struck me as a very elegant expression of something I believe to be true.
Well, and there is something actually Star Trek-like in what this symphony is doing. They're exploring worlds that at one point were known, but going out often into uncharted territory.
That is true. These are new frontiers. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but that's right.
We should say a little bit more about Kirsten,
sure.
Who is this actress and who is at the center of a lot of what takes place in this book. And she is in the strange sort of situation of having been young enough, and we find out fairly early on that mm-hmm. she was one of the child actors who was with Arthur when he dies on stage mm-hmm. at the beginning of the book. She is young enough not really to remember much about the pre-flu world.
That's right. It's a little bit dreamlike to her. At the beginning of the book, as you mentioned, there's a production of King Lear that features the addition of three child actresses in non-speaking roles. So she's there when Arthur dies. She sees the end of the world. We meet up with her again 20 years later. And she's somewhat haunted by these vague memories she has. You know, she remembers, for example, that fridges were cold when you opened the doors, but did they also have light inside, or is that just her imagination, these details that would slip away from you over time?
And there's some, I guess, existential discussion about whether it's important to remember what life was like before or only important to remember what's happened since and concentrate on where things are going now.
That's right. It was something that I found interesting to think about and write about, which would be that 20 years after something like this had happened in a completely altered world, would it actually make sense to tell your kids about what life had been, or would that just be incredibly depressing and or completely abstract to them?
Well, and it's hard to read this book and then watch stories about the Ebola outbreak in Africa and the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And maybe the book seems like a blueprint for our worst fears.
You know, it's interesting. People bring that up a lot at events. And what I find myself thinking about is that there must have been many points in human history, if not every point in human history, where we've felt that things are as bad as they've been and we're just on the brink of disaster. You know, I think about how terrifying it must have been at points during the First and the Second World War, or take 1968 in this country, the riots on the streets, the assassinations, the continued carnage of Vietnam. So it's as though the world's always ending, or at least we always think that way.
History is this crest of a wave, and we don't necessarily see the troughs on either side.
Yes, exactly. It's a good way of putting it.
Well, at the end of the day, when you read this, and you know, again, we don't want to give away the twists and turns that happen, but do you feel like you came out of the process with maybe more hope?
I think that's fair to say. I definitely wrote a hopeful novel, or at least I saw it that way. I've met a couple of readers who disagreed with me on that. But it was very important to me to not write a horror novel, just because that wasn't very interesting to me. And it seemed to me, as I was thinking through this book and then when I wrote it, that even if we lost everything that we take for granted, if all the trappings of civilization were to fall away, I think we would be left with everything that matters. You know, family, friendship, love, these things that would hopefully survive.
Well, Emily St. John Mandel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emily St. John Mandel is the author of the novel Station 11, recently published by Knopf. Her previous books include Last Night in Montreal and The Lola Quartet. She'll read from the new book this evening at 7 at Books & Company in Oconomowoc. And that is the end of today's show. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.
This is the end. You gentle friend. This is the end.